Hi, everyone. Welcome to our AGC podcast series, the Alaska Associated General Contractors puts these series on for all of us to see who our membership is and talk about how their businesses affect the state of Alaska and the construction industry. Today we have our guest is Mr. Mike Heatwall with the Pebble Partnership. Mike, I
got
said
that
your
right.
Name
yeah,
right.
Yeah, perfect. Thank
All
you.
All right, good deal. Well, I mess those up a lot, so and my name gets messed up a lot, so I like to try to make sure I say it correctly. Really, to start off with, Mike, we typically just ask a little bit about your personal history, your family,
Certainly.
And how and when you came to Alaska. Could you maybe enlighten us a little?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I came up when I was 11 years old, so I guess I'm still in the Chuchaco category, right? My father was an exploration geologist with Anaconda Copper, and after the passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, there was kind of a land rush, if you will, from the mineral exploration companies. And so in 1974, we actually started coming up summers, went with him to the camps across Alaska. Very eye-opening, wonderful experience for me to see a lot of Alaska that I think many people don't get the opportunity to
do. So as a young boy,
do.
You were out traveling with your dad?
I was a camp rat, as they say.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Way cool.
And our camp was located in the Western Brooks Range off of the Shugnak River, doing some exploration work again for Anaconda. Got to meet a lot of people through that who I still get to see at the Alaska Miners Association Convention. So that's really kind of a special touch that we have within, the mining industry. And Dad, of course, as soon as he got off the plane in early 74, just fell in love with Alaska and said, we're not moving anywhere else. And of course, the rest is history. And here we are. I was fortunate to be educated in the Anchorage Public School System. And
what high school?
Went to Service High School when it had Hanshoe as its middle school. So we got to go Hanshoe together.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
And then, I think many Alaskans, thought that I needed to go outside for a while, so went to the University of Colorado at Boulder. So I got the outdoor aspects of home, but also got exposure to, a major state university. I ended up getting a degree in journalism, of all things. But when I graduated, the economy was pretty bad in the mid to late 80s. And so long story short, I got an opportunity to go to work for our then U.S. Senator Frank Murkowski. Cut my teeth in public policy, getting to work with him, did some political campaigns, worked for our state legislature when I got the bug to come back to Alaska. And then shortly thereafter, I worked for the Speaker of the House, Gail Phillips, when she was Speaker. A wonderful opportunity. I'm ever grateful for her for giving me that chance. And then worked for Alyeska Pipeline for about 8 years in a similar capacity to what I do here at Pebble. So been working in the kind of communications field, but on and off throughout all of this have really had the opportunity to be a part of a lot of the great resource conversations that, we've had as a state and, very, very small contributions to that. Just a quick side note on a story. So I'm working for Senator Murkowski, and I came home kind of lamenting the grunt staff work, that I was doing. Had a family friend that said, you really don't realize it right now, but this is a wonderful opportunity that later in your career, you'll look back and say how much you really learned from that. And so my time with both Frank Murkowski and Gail Phillips really did teach me a lot about, kind of how government works and this interface between government, public policy, and industry, especially in our state. And so, of course, he was very correct in that advice, and just one of many little pieces of advice I've gotten along the way in my career.
Sure. Well, that's really good. And I want to back up just a little bit. When you were mining there in the Brooks Range with your dad, I mean, so you spent full summers out. Where were you flying out of?
So we would get to Fairbanks and hop on a small plane out of Fairbanks and literally landing on an airstrip out in the middle of nowhere. And of course, this is pre-cell phone and all of that. I remember my sister and I used to just get super excited when the supply plane would buzz the camp, you know, and alert the helicopters to come meet them over at the airstrip, you know, about 5 minutes away. And boy, when that when the supplies came in, that was just so exciting. What came in, and was there a movie, you know, that came in?
Wow, that is exciting. Did you guys spend the whole summer out there mining, or
So we did. And by mining, you know, Dad was he had a crew of geologists that was with him. We had a crew of drillers. So when the geologists would say, okay, hey, we need to go do some additional work over here. Of course, the driller section of camp was off limits to the kids because they were
being a driller, right, I guess I can understand.
Well, that. more because they were going 24/7.
Yeah, right.
And they just, you know, the guys on night shift
that are going full tilt.
Yeah, exactly. So they were doing, they would bring in the core, and you know, Dad would be up there analyzing, you know, what was coming through before sending it off for assays. And really, a lot of that work has become now the, it's in the Ambler Mining District, you know, but the project with our colleagues over at Trilogy Metals, some of the exploration work there, starting to bear fruit now here, some 40 years later. It's kind of exciting to see that.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Well, that's good. So you today, fast forward to modern times, mm-hmm. here, you're working. Are you a family guy?
Absolutely. So yeah. I joke that I'm a chichaco, but I am raising my family here. Okay. I'm married now 19 years. I have a wonderful family. Family is first for me. I have two wonderful kids, 16, 14, Olive and Rennick. As a father, I couldn't ask for anything more.
Oh, great. Well, that's wonderful to hear. Now, you mentioned the school. You mentioned getting involved with Senator Murkowski, mm-hmm. and Gail Phillips, and I'm sure you know her husband, Walt.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Great family.
I spent a lot of time in the field with Walt over the years drilling. But this start in your life through your education and through your initial work got you into this type of work that you're mm-hmm. doing now. And how did that get you into how you're involved with the Associated General Contractors or contractors in general?
Contractors
in general.
So, you know, the contractors in general, you guys build Alaska, right? So the resource end of things, geologists go out and they find some stuff and we get the big projects. But at the end of the day, once the projects go, you pass that baton to get stuff done. You know, you have to roll up the sleeves and build our economy. And I think it's really important to emphasize the importance of resource development across the economy, because without that injection of economic activity, you know, we really don't have an economy in Alaska. I'm a student of history. I love history. Drives my poor kids crazy because I point out all kinds of stuff that they roll their eyes at. But someday I hope they'll get it.
Keep doing it.
Yeah, exactly. But I like to ground a lot of conversations in why Alaska and how we came into the Union. You know, there were two arguments against statehood for Alaska. The first is kind of funny in the modern time, but they didn't want to bring another two senators into the United States Senate that were going to be Democratic senators. And of course, Alaska's history is a little bit different in that frame. But the other was how could a large state in terms of its land basis support an economy for such a small population. And so, of course, the statehood compact gave Alaska title to over 100 million of our 365 million acres for the purposes of supporting an economy. And in Alaska, you know, to this day and probably for many eons into our future, it's all going to be about how do we harness that land base for economic development via resource development.
Yeah. Well, that's a good little piece of Alaskan history. I like that. Well, since we're talking about history, mm-hmm. I'd like to roll right into Your spin on the Pebble Mine history, if you could enlighten us a little bit on that. I know it's quite a few years, but and I know there's been a lot of ups and downs in the history of the Pebble Mine and now the current Pebble Partnership. If you could just kind of roll us through that.
Absolutely. So it segues well with the discussion about Alaska's history, because the land where Pebble is, of course, State of Alaska land. And one of the designated uses of that land, of course, is mineral. They say it's called open to mineral entry, which really means you can go explore. If you find something, you have the opportunity to make your case for mining it. But I think a lot gets lost in the controversy around Pebble, that this is a state asset. It's for the people of Alaska. The land was specifically selected, among many other things, for its mineral potential. It was actually the subject of a three-way land exchange between the federal government, the state government, and Cook Inlet Regional, CIRI. CIRI had some holdings in Lake Clark Park that the federal government wanted to get so they could, you know, kind of have their whole land status for the park be secure. There was some land that the state had that CIRI had its eyes on the Kenai Peninsula, and so the state grabs the Pebble deposit or the lands around Pebble as part of this three-way land exchange. So fast forward from that point, so it's open to mineral entry, and there's some geologists who have come into Iliamna in the mid to late 1980s looking for gold. They worked for Cominco. They're talking to the local air taxi operator, a fellow by the name of Tim Laporte, who runs Iliamna Air Taxi. And he starts asking, well, what are you guys looking for? And so they describe, you know, they're looking for, you know, land coloration so they can see if the minerals are expressing themselves on the surface. And Tim describes what will become the discovery outcrop for Pebble, this little bit of rust color out in the middle of the Pebble deposit. And the geologists, as the story goes, were out there the next day, staking their claims, and they start doing some initial work and find minerals, but nothing of enough to really justify and warrant mining. You fast forward to the early 2000s, where Northern Dynasty Minerals is looking at some of the old assays that exist out there for Cominco, who again was looking for gold. Northern Dynasty was looking for more minerals, and you know, were really focused on copper. And so they start ramping up the exploration and environmental studies work in the early 2000s there. And in all of their subsequent summer seasons, start to really define a very significant deposit of copper, gold, molybdenum under the ground at Pebble. And by volume and value, it's a copper play. Value is roughly 60% copper, 30 gold, and 10 other minerals. We've reassayed actually some of our minerals here recently and discovered that there's actually quite a bit of silver within our mineral portfolio. So in the 2000s, mid-2000s, their activity really starts to ramp up. They realize they have such a significant deposit under the ground that they want to attract a longer-term major mining company to be a partner. And in 2007, they attracted the interest of Anglo American. And then the Pebble Partnership itself was formed. And for the next, 5 years off of that, you know, really significant volume of work done. And so up to this point, you know, the controversy is slowly starting to build. You know, we had our first real, ballot campaign in 2008. You know, and I think the controversy starts to get a foothold under a massive misinformation campaign that gets traction because the proponent, in this case us, we really don't have our mine plan on the table. And you know, so we're constantly trying to defend ourselves against, you know, legacy mines from the lower 48, you know, not being able to address things with a lot of specificity. And also we really undertook a massive environmental studies program. And as we work our way into the early kind of 2010s, if you will, that environmental studies program, the data from that starts to get fit into our really sophisticated modeling work so that we can meet our commitment to coexist with the fishery. We may touch on that a little bit down the road. And in terms of history, as we're rolling up to really get a project out there in the 2013 timeframe, something is happening worldwide where commodity prices are starting to tank. And as a result, all the major mining companies are changing out their leadership teams, Anglo American among them, and their new CEO comes in and puts all their projects into three buckets. You know, existing projects, where we're operating, around the world, and how can we maximize our return for our shareholders through that. Projects that are either in construction or have secured that final permit to operate, we're going to really focus on that because that's the feedstock to operations, is to get stuff going. Everything else is what they call long lead projects, and that's where Pebble falls in, and they couldn't advance it, and as a result walked away because they were really walking away from most of their longer lead projects. And so since that time frame, we've been looking to establish a longer term partner. We have received enough money to get us into permitting. We changed CEOs in 2014 from John Shively to Tom Collier, and Collier challenges the engineers and says, can we, in response to stakeholders, can we design a smaller project that still meets all the environmental criteria and economic criteria and get that into permitting, which we achieve in late 2017, and start the formal NEPA review process. And we have a draft environmental impact statement, public comment window closes July 1 on that. And the significance of that for the project, which is very exciting, is now we have a plan on the table that we can start to respond to a lot of the critiques. And I think something else that's important, and I'm going off on all kinds of rabbit holes, I apologize. Something else that's important is throughout the course of this, and why Collier's challenge to the engineers is very significant, is people ask me a lot in our public forums, well, how do you characterize or how do you feel about all the opposition that's been generated to the project? And I'll say that opponents of projects serve an important role in the public dialogue because they bring forward issues of concern that need to be addressed by the proponent. Now, where we get a little bit of a disagreement is when those answers may not necessarily satisfy, or the opponents might want to look for, well, okay, you answered those 10 questions and now I got more that, and it's just more. But what we've done is we designed a very responsive project to a lot of the concerns that we've heard, from safeguards to the tailing storage facilities, how we manage water at the site. We're not going to use cyanide for secondary gold recovery at the project. The smaller, more compact footprint. We're out of the upper Tellaric Quijag drainage. A lot of pretty major steps that we've taken that I don't think we've gotten a fair amount of a positive response to that, but it's there. I think that's really important in the modern resource development ranks, where you do need to listen to stakeholders and bring into the project team those concerns so they can be appropriately addressed. A lot of times it's just general misinformation, or people have just concerns that need a lot more explanation, and once they achieve that, and they'll have a different view of the project.
So I see. Just I've been, of course, involved indirectly or directly over the last since you guys started looking at this, and our business has been around for 49 years, so we've been involved with all the mines throughout the state. Mm-hmm. One thing you did say that caught my attention was you were talking about how the legacy mines in Lower 48 mm-hmm. were not necessarily in your corner. Is it? What could you?
Yeah. So what's interesting about that, and I think someday somebody will write a book about, I think Pebble comes of age in really the digital age, right? So the social media, what happens on the other end of the world shows up on a Facebook video or a television ad. Then the next couple of days. What I mean about the legacy mines of the Lower 48, a lot of Alaskans who have moved north, coming from western states, may have a familiarity with with mines or with mining, and in many cases, it may not be a positive experience because of the legacy environmental issues that were generated there. And what gets lost in this is, so people are talking about mines of 60, 70 years ago that did have environmental issues, that don't take into account what happened in the United States politically in the late 1960s and early 70s with this real environmental ethos, and we pass, you know, the alphabet soup of environmental laws. NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, Endangered Species Act. You know, if you name it, it's an environmental law. It was largely passed in that window. And then what happens is, you know, I mentioned I was a student of history, I also apologize ahead of time, but then what happens is you have to really establish the regulatory framework for how are we going to implement as a country all of these mass. I mean, these are big, big changes. It says, you know, if you're going to discharge water, you shall meet this criteria. And in a lot of cases, the technology wasn't even there. And so you need 10, 15 years to sort this out through the courts. What's this really going to look like? How are we, the federal government, going to have this implemented in states that are as different as Texas and Alaska, and a whole bunch of things that need to happen. In the meantime, of course, operations continue to go. So that's kind of point one on what I'll call the legacy issues, is newer mines that are coming online post that have to meet the clean air, clean water, and all these other considerations. There's also this issue of mines not being effectively closed in these legacy mines. My dad tells a great story about how it used to be in mining. So the mining engineer and the geologists are, you know, 5-10 years into their operation, and the geologist starts to point out to the mining engineer on the operation side and say, you know, we're going to run out of minerals here in about 5 years. They start crunching the numbers and they say, uh-oh, we've got a problem. And so they just walk away. And so the citizens of the Western United States primarily said, well, that's just not right, because now we're left with this environmental legacy, and it's not fair to the taxpayer to have to pick this up. So what happens is two really major changes. So in addition to this suite of environmental laws in the 70s that come online, mining states now require a closure plan as one of the key permits to operate. So how are you going to close it before we're going to give you the license to start it? And secondly, you're going to put up a bond so that when we go to the taxpayer, you're not going to have a taxpayer liability, so that if for some reason you go financially insolvent, we're not leaving the taxpayer holding the bag. I think those are really important pieces, because I still hear it today in public forums. They say, well, what if you walk away? You're just going to leave Alaska taxpayers with a liability. And it's just simply not the case because of the changes that have been made.
Yeah, if you read this morning's paper, and I know you see this in our local newspapers mm-hmm. around the state consistently, is just exactly how are you going to leave things? And this past, unfortunately, mining's got a black eye over the historically.
Yeah.
For those incidents, mm-hmm. and they always throw out that what is it, the Poly mine? I mean, they throw out these mines that have had problems,
right.
And you're constantly at the forefront of the defending and
right.
explaining it, and it's good to hear that you guys do have a plan and you're going to be implementing that. So that's a good little bit of history there. I like that. We can see historically that, you know, we had the Kennecott mine was a big copper mine in our state. Mm-hmm. And I guess what as an Alaskan historically, I always wonder, you know, Pebble is, you know, and I've flown out in that region a few times. It just seems kind of out there, a little different from when you get around the Wrangells and you look at mm-hmm. the Kennecott mine.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit on how, you know, they found it, they located it, and why they weren't maybe in a different a geologic structure?
Certainly. So it brings up kind of some interesting pieces. So all of the easy, I'll call them easy, all of the easy copper plays have been found. So Kennecott, you know, you and I, who may not have a geology background, we can walk around and say, there's something in those rocks, right? At Pebble, it's very different. We're what's considered a low-grade deposit, and that just means that for every ton of rock, you know, we may have a fraction of a percent or 1-3% mineralization. So the minerals, you know, for every ton you mine, you're only getting 1-3% that you're going to take off to a smelter to turn into metal. But that's how mines are coming into into production these days. We're not an outlier by any stretch. And so that's just one, you know, kind of major difference between Pebble and, say, the Kennecott. The geology is very different. So there you're looking at mountains, and you see the surface expressions very, very visible and obvious to you. Out in the area around Pebble, it's largely been scoured by glaciers, you know, in the last ice age they came through. And so the topography is very different. In fact, the engineers will go stand out there on the Pebble deposit and look around and say, this is a pretty easy undertaking just from a straight, you know, kind of engineering perspective, because it's very relatively flat. You know, under our new plan too, we had looked at a road corridor along the north shore of Iliamna Lake, but that got really challenging as you got closer to the west side of Cook Inlet, not unlike the topography from Anchorage down to Girdwood. You know, literally the mountains dropping right into tidewater, and presents a very costly, not insurmountable, but just adds a lot to the cost. And the engineers start looking, well, if we go south, what does that do for us? And so now we're looking at a port facility, a place called Amakdadori, running a road up to the south end of Iliamna Lake, and then having an ice-breaking ferry to transport goods that are coming in and the mineral concentrate coming out to the north shore of Iliamna Lake, and then a road on up into the mine site. So, but back to your, you know, the question, there are definite differences from that. One of the challenges that you hear the public discussion, people say, well, can't you just mine this somewhere else? Well, the minerals are where they are, right? Mm-hmm. And in our case, not unlike any other place in Alaska, one of the key hurdles to overcome is infrastructure. You know, yes, the minerals are where they are, but Alaska is a largely underdeveloped state when it comes to infrastructure. We largely have the road and rail system that takes us up into the interior, pipeline on up to the North Slope, and the road that connects us with Canada. Everything else is by river or air. And, you know, our colleagues up at Trilogy looking at the Ambler Road project. At Pebble, we need to, you know, build about a 60 miles worth of road, bring in 180 mile gas line in order to get the power that we need. Alaska's we have the resources, but we are really challenged as a state when it comes to infrastructure. My father is actually consulting for a project in Nevada, one of our stops before we came north to Alaska, and he says a copper play there. But he gets to point out that they're close to rail, they're close to the electric grid, and, you know, roads are all over Nevada, so infrastructure is in place, which is a big cost consideration. And so Alaska, when we talk about, you know, the size of minerals that are, and deposits that need to be found, you really do need to find larger deposits in order to justify or amortize that pretty significant infrastructure cost that comes with it.
Yeah, speaking about that, I was reading on your website, and the one thing that did catch my eye, and I always look at this when I'm looking at, you know, development as an Alaska kid, mm-hmm. born and raised. Yep. I'm a pro-development guy, and yep. I like seeing what development of our natural resources brings to our state, you know, which in my business is jobs and right. work, and which there's so much of Alaska where there really aren't any jobs or work, or if there are mines, they're very small mom and pop mines. Mm-hmm. They're not big developments that provide long-term jobs that help the communities. And I mean, we've been blessed with six mines. Yep. Currently. Mm-hmm. that are providing good jobs around our state. And obviously this pebble mine, where it's located, I know you did move it, correct, a little bit. You rearranged it.
The footprint, yes.
Yeah, the footprint of it. Mm-hmm. And you definitely talked briefly about how you were moving the, you changed the road. And I know the road, I read a lot about the trying to get the environmental impact statement for the road. There was a little bit of pushback, not just from environmentalists, but possibly from locals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, on that road system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now you're coming forward with the ferry system. Is there, I mean, I'm not a boat guy, but I'm just thinking winter operations.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you, could you enlighten us a little bit on how you at the Pebble there see that working, that ferry system, and also that road to Cook Inlet to
certainly
a deep water ferry port?
So it's interesting how this even came to our attention. I mentioned the engineers were early on looking at that northern road route. We had been talking about probably some type of modularized construction in order to bring, float the modules in. And they very quickly said, we need to put in a temporary road to float some stuff across Iliamna Lake. And so that's how we kind of end up in that particular alignment. Another engineer had some experience with an ice-breaking ferry in northern British Columbia. And up in there, it's called the Williston Transporter. And it was for a logging operation that had a traditional road route that they were getting their logs to market that way. Then the government of Canada came in and put in a hydro dam and flooded their road route. And they're, of course, scratching their heads on, well, what are we going to do during winter operations? And they came up with this concept of an ice-breaking ferry. And so that's kind of how we start to get the idea. And the more we bounce the idea around, the more we start to like it. And it looks at about one transport across the Iliamna Lake per day. So basically we take containerized, the mineral concentrate will be in containers, so sealed, transported by truck, then stockpiled there at the northern ferry terminal, loaded onto the ice-breaking ferry and brought across to the southern terminal, and then ultimately that is taken to a port facility at Amokdadori. We're actually going to use a lightering concept there too. Some earlier concepts around Amokdadori required a pretty significant dredging operation, and very quickly realized that was probably a no-go on many fronts from an environmental and cost basis. And so we'll load them onto the containerized mineral concentrate onto a barge. That'll go off to be a lightering barge to the bulk carrier, where basically the containerized mineral concentrates are lifted off the lightering barge and lowered deep into the hold and then opened up as part of the drop, which really minimizes the issue of dust. So it's kind of a neat concept. But the transportation and that road route become very significant. And one of our kind of key issues in working with the community, so Iliamna Lake in the wintertime will freeze up and it becomes a winter transportation route. And one of the things we've had conversations about it, because this generated a ton of questions from the community, and primarily around a lot of people have lost relatives around the lake in the wintertime on the lake, snow machining, and then just either hitting open water or who knows what. And so we were looking at a range of what we'll call mitigation factors that we actually think working with the communities may improve the safety of that as a winter transportation corridor, where you might build a road around your ferry terminal where it might inconvenience somebody a little bit to have to make that run. But in the long run, I think you improve the safety. But the other thing that's kind of interesting is that as the climate continues to change, the last several years, the lake actually hasn't frozen over. So it hasn't necessarily been used as that transportation corridor as it had been 10, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So that is interesting. Well, so let me get this right. So you're bringing your ore into Iliamna.
To a ferry location.
To a ferry
There's two that are being evaluated right now by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in the draft environmental impact statement. You know, one of the many factors that you get within the DEIS are alternatives. So there are two different locations on the north shore of Iliamna Lake that could be used as ferry terminals. Same goes for ferry terminals on the southern end of the lake around Kakanok. And so one of the things that's happening in the comment period is that locals are expressing their preferences as to where they would like to see it. And there's pros and cons, obviously, in both locations. Mm-hmm. One example is if we go to a place called Eagle Bay on the north shore of Iliamna Lake, it allows for a pipeline alignment that could go right through Iliamna, which is very appealing to the residents of Iliamna, New Halen, to be able to potentially tie into that gas. And one of the things that we did in our gas pipeline was to make sure that we had extra capacity built in it so that if people did want to tie into it, that opportunity would be there. And one of the key benefits that comes from mineral development and the installation of infrastructure is that others can benefit from it. I don't think many Alaskans are familiar with in Juneau, the city of Juneau gets all of its electrical power from the hydroelectric facilities that are there. However, most don't know that it was the mines that put them in order to get the power that they needed to run their operations, and they ultimately handed that operation over to the local utility.
So there's a benefit of the power.
Yep.
And I was going to get into that here in a little bit, where it's access to lower power cost. And so I would assume that that's what you're talking about. And this
gas is
being piped over from Cook Inlet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's Cook Inlet
tying
gas
into the Cook Inlet system. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's great information. So you're at one or two sites on the north side,
yep.
and then you're looking at ferrying across. On an ice breaking ferry.
Yep.
And you haven't had ice here the last few years, so there's a benefit to that, I would imagine, and the cost of trying to get material across the lake. Mm-hmm. You've got two sites on the south side that you're also looking at. One's close to Kakanok.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. And then what kind of and this is AGC type jobs. Mm-hmm. What kind of work to the road getting to Cook Inlet improvements? Can you comment on what improvements might be needed to that corridor of road from the south shore of Lake Iliamna to Cook Inlet?
To the port, sure.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to need it's roughly 30 miles of road there on the southern alignment. And what's interesting in all of this, you start talking infrastructure, and the immediate question we get is, okay, well, what about access? And the issue of access is very interesting to me because it is largely depends on where you're from. So I'm having this conversation in Naknek at a public forum, and people want to know there, well, is it going to be open access for all? Because if you're in Naknek, you're very interested in if goods can come in on that road. Can it drop the cost for, you know, not having to ship them all the way around around the chain? If you're in Kenai, it becomes an interesting question, because could opening roads and other opportunities alleviate pressures on fishing potentially from around the Kenai system? Now, if you're in Kakanok, you have a very, you know, interest too in limiting access on that road, because you don't necessarily want to have an influx of population. Same in Iliamna, New Halen. So the issue of access and infrastructure becomes a very interesting one for the proponent, because the issues are very different depending upon the stakeholder group that you're talking to. And so our assumption, so it's interesting too, is around Kakanok, those are Alaska Peninsula Corporation lands. We have an infrastructure agreement with them. Up on the other end of the lake, it's a mix between Alaska Peninsula Corporation lands and Iliamna Natives Limited lands. But then as you work your way closer to going up to the mine site and then coming south, working your way towards the port, you transition into State of Alaska land. And so we're starting under the basis that this will be a private road with restricted access as the starting point. But as a company, you want to leave it open for discussions with the various user groups. And when you start with that basis of a private road, you know, for security and safety reasons, it allows you to back it away on maybe a staged basis rather than saying what's going to be an open access 100%, because that can create some, just from the operator's perspective, that can create some challenges for you. I mentioned security and safety, which of course are very paramount to us as a company.
And that's not unique. I mean, Pogo Mine, Fort Knox, all these mines have got limited access to them. You need to, makes sense. I mean, I get that.
Yeah.
I am curious though, because I can see where politically all these different people involved in it and communities involved in it would have interest in it, because there are some benefits to having open access, having a mine come in and build us a road that we're all allowed to use.
Yep.
But there's, with, we all know, if we've been around a mine, we know that there's big equipment that's rolling on the road, and the average person in a minivan shouldn't be around that stuff.
Exactly right.
So,
yeah.
So, or if they are, they need to be well educated in it. So, well, that gives us a good idea as to what's going on with your mine there. Now, you're with the Pebble Partnership, and why don't you tell us a little bit? I mean, I'm reading this as a Pebble Limited Partnership, and we're talking a lot about your environmental impact statement comment period that I guess has been extended a little bit.
Yep.
If you could, please tell me a little bit about the partnership. I mean, that changed a little bit, right?
Right. So the Pebble Partnership was established in 2007 between Northern Dynasty Minerals and Anglo American. As we talked about earlier, Anglo American left in the fall of 2013, had very significant impact immediately on the project. We went from 95 employees to 12 overnight. It was a rough period for us. And corresponds with some pretty aggressive moves by the Obama-era Environmental Protection Agency, has influence over that as well. However, moving forward, Northern Dynasty Minerals has gone to market to raise funds periodically to keep the project moving forward. That's how things work in the capitalist society. We've got an asset, we need money, we raise money through stock and things of that nature and other investors. We did attract the interest of First Quantum Minerals in 2018. They gave us some seed money, but for a variety of reasons, they backed away from their interest. We still have conversations with a range of people. We're looking now, at who can we line up as a partner to really get us through the federal permitting. And once we can demonstrate we can get that, we believe then others will be interested in helping us advance it. Until we secure all of our permits, I think it will probably be some type of structure where, two, three, or maybe a handful of major companies will come in to help finance what will be a multi-billion-dollar construction project for the project. And so that's what the Pebble Limited Partnership is right now. And one of the interesting sidebars, I saw it in an opinion piece this morning too in the paper, we frequently get attacked for being a foreign mining company. And it really grates me as an Alaskan, because every one of our resource sectors is completely dependent upon outside Alaska investment, and more often than not, foreign investment. Our colleagues in the oil and gas industry, there's a lot of foreign investment within that. We welcome that investment. The fishing industry has a lot of foreign investment, primarily from Asian customers. We welcome that investment to keep that industry solvent. Tourism has a lot of foreign investment, and as a state, we just don't have the population basis that supports the capital investment that we need to keep our economy going. And so, yes, there is foreign investment involved in the Pebble project, involved in mining, and I think as Alaskans, we need to welcome that, because that's how this economy grows, is through through that steady flow of people being willing to invest in advancing projects in Alaska, which drives our economy.
And these foreign investors, or I should say just investors in general, the larger investors, the large interests, they are still kind of holding their cards close to their chest to see how you guys work sure. with all mm-hmm. your EIS yeah. and all of those things.
Well, it's interesting too. It's just because a company is headquartered in another country, many of the investors and institutional investors are domestic. You know, so all of us are through our portfolios, our 401ks and things of that nature. We probably have resource stocks within it. So many of us are shareholders in other organizations that are investing back in Alaska. And you know, it is a global economy, and I think that sometimes we can lose a little sight of that.
Yeah. I read a book here a while ago called My Electrician Drives a Porsche.
Right.
I think it was. It was an interesting read. The guy was really elaborating on electricity and the importance of copper.
Yep.
You know, and of course I've shared that book with friends and with my children, and I think it's interesting, and I think as Alaskans, you know, we've got a natural resource out there that you guys are working very hard at trying to develop. And like I said before, I spoke with John Shively about this. I know he carried the torch for many, many
yes.
years, and he still
yeah.
does.
He hired me.
Yeah.
I have a lot of time and respect, and I've
yeah.
learned a lot from John over the years.
He's a great yep. person and a great torchbearer for mining in Alaska. And I just see the future. I mean, I as an Alaskan, I appreciate what you do. And hopefully you'll be able to continue to do with your Pebble partnership. Mm-hmm. We're you know, through the AGC here, we're constantly looking for jobs. And
yep.
again, that's where you guys would help us out once you get a little bit more traction. In the near future, I know that this comment period on the EIS is coming up.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see after that comment period is over? Can you kind of give us a snapshot of what
Certainly.
Your view of the next mm-hmm. year might be?
Yeah, so what happens once the comment period for the draft environmental impact statement closes, the Corps of Engineers and their third-party contractor, who is usually hired to help them do all of the work on the EIS, is they'll start to work on a final environmental impact statement for Pebble. But as part of that, they have to go through every single comment they receive, and they're looking for genuinely, I'll call them constructive comments. So people who have taken a few minutes to read through aspects of the draft EIS, and say you're somebody in Kakanak or New Halen who's worried about a particular aspect of the ferry that you and I were just talking about, you know, and they've commented on that, and the Corps and its contractor will take a look at that, and they'll have to incorporate that in their final. Or say you're in New Halen and you're really concerned about the population growth and the impacts on the health infrastructure that are there. You know, what are the plans? You know, Lake Peninsula Borough is the local government for this area. You know, they'll have substantive comments about, you know, what does this really mean, both the opportunity and then the challenges that come with major changes in, you know, kind of political, economic, and population activity. So all of these substantive comments need to be addressed. You know, some will be the I hate Pebble, I love Pebble, and those will largely just get, you know, comment noted, because really those aren't a substantive contribution to what's within the draft environmental impact statement. So that will happen over the course of the next, you know, 8, 10, 12 months as the Corps will work on finalizing an EIS, which they have said by their schedule should be out sometime early 2020. And then after that has been published, they will then work for a couple of months on what's called the Record of Decision, which is really their determination on can the project go forward. So that's what's next in the timeline for the Pebble project. We've got some work in the near future out at our site in Iliamna that needs to be done that start to feed more information into that EIS process, and we're going to bring out a pretty significant drill rig this year to do some hydro testing that our standard drills can't do. It needs more horsepower. One of the interesting aspects of Pebble that's not well known is that all of our work out at the Pebble deposit has to be done by helicopter. This is not road based. You know, on a road, you can get a rig that might be on a tractor, and you can move a lot larger equipment. And so we've had to work with a vendor to design one that can be broken up enough that we can be transported and reassemble it by helicopter load. And so we're finalizing
that
right
now.
It's
going to
be I think it may be a sonic type drill. It's got a pressure thing. It's a hydrostatic, not hydrostatic, because that's water, but it won't use, it won't be a rotary using drill muds or anything because of the specific water work we're doing. So it's just a fascinating.
Probably a sonic drill.
Yeah, but just to be able to do that. So that's the near term per your your question on what comes next. And then we have the whole state permitting process, and so
how long is that process?
That can be 2 or 3 years in the making. And what's interesting is a lot of focus gets put on this this environmental impact statement, but there's a large volume of work, there's a lot of detailed permits that need to happen via the state. Our dam certification for tailings, really important aspect. Our air and water permits, so water discharge, have to meet the state's criteria. As we started out talking about the history of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, many of the states have different unique circumstances. I mentioned Texas is very different from Arizona. It's very different from Alaska. And so all of the states of the union sought primacy from the EPA to be able to administer the air and water programs. You meet the federal criteria, but you establish your state-specific program given the unique circumstances that are in each state. And so in the case of Pebble and our water program, that's a really important permit for us to acquire from the State Department of Environmental Conservation on the waterfront.
Mm. All right. So that brings you up to like 2023, 2024, yeah. and then the next phase. If all that gets taken care of,
yep.
All that gets approved,
then we go to construction, right?
That's where we come in. That's where we come in.
Extensive construction project. I mentioned multi-billion-dollar. We got to build a. We got to lay a pipeline across Cook Inlet. We have to build a port and lightering facility at Amakadori. We have to build a road. We have to build an ice-breaking ferry. Got to get the next road up to the mine site, and then we got to put in all of the mine equipment. We estimate probably 2,000 jobs just to do construction. Once we do construction, 3 to 4 years worth of work there. As I mentioned, multi-billion-dollar. That'd be a serious injection to the Southwest and South Central economies to accomplish that. We go into operations, about 850 direct workers for operations, and probably an equal number on the contract side. Doing a lot of the work that we don't necessarily want to be doing ourselves. The camp services, security services. A lot of not direct. Not directly associated with mining. 20 years of operation and then a period of what's called active closure. So one of the requirements of closure is to remove all of the facilities that aren't needed for the long haul. That's probably another 10-year window just to accomplish closure. I think in our industry, this notion of closure is widely misunderstood because it's a very significant undertaking. You have many Alaskans are probably not even familiar with the requirements. Once the Trans-Alaska pipeline is no longer needed, the requirements are that it's supposed to be removed, and all of those facilities are supposed to remove too as part of their closure. And that's not an insignificant undertaking, given what it took to put it in.
Sure. Well, when you look at your timeline here, you're looking at maybe. What, 2030 being ready to actually start your 20-year mine operations?
Yeah, give or take.
Give or take.
Yeah.
And then historically what we've seen with other mines, active mines in the state, they tend to roll beyond their anticipated, active
sure
level. What are there any thoughts about that? Are you guys as investors and
yeah, so
do you talk about that?
Certainly. Just like, it, as you mentioned, every other mining project, the most recent example being the Akaloq deposit up at the Red Dog mine, where they've been able to talk about bringing in another deposit online and extending mine life for a window. Our colleagues at Fort Knox doing the same thing. Should there be a future decision to continue mining at Pebble, that will be subject to its own additional full, federal and state permitting and review process, the same undertaking we're doing right now. It's a multi-year endeavor, and has to stand on its own. It will have to have a closure plan that takes into account all of the, all the things that have been done to date, in addition to what they want to, would want to look at into the future. So short answer is that's indeed a possibility. And we've been focusing our attention right now on trying to get this 20-year project across the finish line to get to the start line.
Understood. I just like to hear that there's even the potential for more. So it's always good to hear those things. That's all good stuff. Well, I probably could go on forever talking to you about this. It's real interesting. I mean, you're a very positive individual, and you've got great history here you've enlightened us with. I will say, I sense that, this is all the good stuff that me as an Alaskan and me as a person who likes to hear about resource development enjoys. Part of your job, though, is even during all this time, you still got a lot of work in front of you, as you say, to finish up your federal permitting, finish up your state permitting. Plus, like I say, I read all these articles that you read every time you pick up a newspaper. You have your detractors that you are going to continually be dealing with.
Yep.
And I would say, as just a common Alaskan, it seemed like there was a period of time where historically it looked like the Pebble mine it wasn't going to be.
Yep.
And then it resurrected itself, and which makes guys like me happy. Can you tell me how you're going to continue to fight that fight?
Sure. Well, the main one is, I mentioned that we finally have a plan that we put on the table that's defensible. And when you have a conversation where you're rooted in, I hear it's going to do this. And you say, well, what have I told you that it's going to be X, Y, and Z? Oh, I hadn't thought of that. And if I can tell you that we're going to take care of the fish and water resources out there in Bristol Bay, you start to see, so people say, oh, okay. And so we've been on a pretty aggressive communications program, not a lot of call television advertising and stuff like that, but rather small group settings where we have the opportunity for long conversations like you and I are having here today, Ron, where we're able to talk through issues of concern. In fact, this bears out in our polling, where people who say that they're very much opposed to the Pebble project, but we say, well, are you open to changing your views if it can, be demonstrated that the project can be done safely and responsibly? A vast majority of folks will say, yes, I'm willing to hear more, because many who've been here for a while and see the economic opportunities that can come. If you can demonstrate that you can meet the criteria that the state has for development, which frankly, as an Alaskan and as a proponent, we have to do anyway, right? Because we're not going to get a permit at the expense of another industry. That's not how permitting in Alaska works, and nor should it be. And so what's really exciting about the draft EIS is that it specifically says in there that, the Corps has looked at this, and they say if the operator does everything that they've put on paper here, their technical information, it makes sense. And if they do everything they say here, it's not going to have a long-term impact to the fish and water resources in Bristol Bay or Cook Inlet, for that matter. And it's an important point of emphasis, because as Alaskans, you know, we're every one of us. You talk about salmon, and people get excited, right? We all like to go fill our freezers with a few salmon. I happen to have a neighbor who's a commercial fisherman, and I prefer to fill my freezer via his efforts because it's a little more, you know, yeah. On a cost basis, it makes a little more sense. But I do like to take my kids out too. Like to put the fish on the grill, you know. And there's something you know deeply and uniquely Alaskan about that, and we get it. And frankly, with our stakeholders out in the region, we recognize the cultural value of salmon to our rural communities and the commercial value. But at the end of the day, you know, Alaska is a resource state, and the projects need to coexist with each other, and that's an important part of it too. I do want to throw in a pitch as we trend to wrap up here. Pebble's a copper resource, really important to our society. You talked about the book. We have been mining copper in the world for about 5,000 years. And we've mined 550 million tons of copper in that window. As we talk about a low carbon future, if we talk about Green New Deals, whether the politics of it are appealing to you or not, you know, if we start talking about all of these major changes as a society, batteries, wind turbines, electric cars, you know, solar panels, it all requires mined products. I saw a stat from the World Bank and said, if we want to meet all of these requirements, we're going to need to mine another 550 million tons of copper in the next 30 years.
Wow.
And the question to pose to people, including my friends in the environmental community, is, okay, you're either, what are you going to give up, or where are we going to get it? And are we going to turn a blind eye as Alaskans and Americans and say, well, we're just going to mine it and take those products from places that don't have the environmental ethos that we have? Or are we going to look to projects like Pebble, which are going to be developed under arguably some of the highest standards in the world, and get the economic benefits that come with it while meeting our environmental standards?
Mm-hmm. Well, very, very well put there. Well, I can't thank you enough for educating us today. I mean, as you've gone through a great history here on the short time that Pebble has been around, but it's a very interesting project, and it sounds like you're getting close to getting beyond the goal line here.
Slowly but surely,
yeah,
right?
We wish you all the best in that. We're looking forward to you guys continuing on. To wrap up, I usually ask what do you have for the rest of the summer here. You say you might be going fishing with the kids.
Well, actually, for the rest of summer, I have one really exciting thing happening. My son, who's 14, is a Boy Scout. He's been at it now for a couple years. Really wants to get his eagle. He's very excited by that. But our troop is taking a group to the Boy Scout Ranch at Philmont, New Mexico, northeastern New Mexico, about 6,000 feet. And over 10 days, we're going to trek, I think it's 80 miles, backpack. We get reprovisioned every 3 days, but we've been working towards that. And just the opportunity to have some bonding time with my son.
Sounds like
a neat deal.
Great adventure.
Yeah.
Well, good for you. Well, as I said, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your schedule to come talk to us today. And we wish you all the best in the future.
Super.
And keep up the hard work there on the Pebble Partnership.
Great. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you much.
Thank you for listening to the Alaska Works Podcast, brought to you by a generous contribution from the Construction Industry Progress Fund and the Associated General Contractors of Alaska.